You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's programme...
This selective tax treatment of Apple in Ireland is illegal under EU state aid rules.
Apple has been ordered to pay £11 billion in tax by the European Commission. What will it mean for the tech giant's operations? And as Turkish tanks roll across the border with Syria, we'll ask whether Turkey's relationship with the US is at breaking point. Also ahead, the UK's Prime Minister will meet her cabinet tomorrow. Can Britain restrict immigration and retain access to the single market? Plus... We'll be asking whether anything can be done to prevent Venice's cultural heritage being ruined by tourists. Yes, that's you. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Martin Sanbu, economics writer at the Financial Times, and Robert Fox, who is the defence editor at the London Evening Standard. And we're going to start with the European Commission, which says that Ireland should recover up to £11 billion in tax from Apple. A three-year-long investigation by the Commission has concluded that the US firm's tax benefits are illegal. This is what Margarita Vestager, the EU Commissioner in charge of competition, had to say a little bit earlier.
This selective tax treatment of Apple in Ireland is illegal under EU state aid rules. It gave Apple a significant benefit compared to other businesses. Tax rulings cannot endorse a methodology or a method to calculate taxable profits of a business that fails to reflect economic activity, or the reality for that matter. So, what are the consequences of this decision for Ireland and for Apple? To restore fair competition, Apple must recover up to 13 billion euros in unpaid taxes from Apple plus interest.
Martin, can you translate that into English for me? What on earth was she on about?
Well, the English is sort of plain enough. They have to pay 13 billion euros, or up to 13 billion euros. This is huge. But it's also very interesting because... You might have missed it, but this is not actually a tax ruling, it's a competition ruling. So under EU rules, a government can't subsidise one company and favour it over other companies. And that's essentially the EU argument, that Dublin has said, we'll do a special deal for Apple, under which, according to the Commission, they've paid tax on their European profits at a rate that was 1% and ended up being 0.005%. That's against the sort of notional 12.5% in Ireland, which is already one of Europe's lowest, and more than 30% in the US, where Apple is really from. So what they've done is to say, well, we're going to use competition policy to try to partly slam this company, partly try to push tax reform forward. Tax reform itself is very difficult, very political, both within Europe and in the relations between the EU and the US, which has complained about this.
Now, before I bring in Robert, just tell me, who had the useless lawyers then? Ireland? Apple? Because yeah, how do you walk yourself into a situation like this where you suddenly wake up thinking, oh dear, I owe £11 billion to the taxman? Who advised them? Is it because the law's a bit opaque or there's a bit of mystery around it? Why did it go so horribly wrong?
I'm sure everyone has very well-paid lawyers on all sides. They'll be making out on this. But the thing is that the politics has changed. This is not just the law, right? This is the sort of thing that's been going on for decades. And actually, the rulings, the Dublin tax special deal for Apple that they've talked about, that there are two rulings that are quite old. So there's this sort of come home to roost much, much later on. After it was initially decided. And that's partly because, you know, everyone used to be doing this and the environment has changed generally in favour of taxing corporations more harshly.
Robert, not a good time to be Irish, is it? We've just had the Olympics where they seem to be up to all sorts of dodgy deals in hotel bedrooms. And now they're doing the same with their tax rates. Is this a problem peculiar to the Irish, do you think?
Yet we're led to believe it's a land of opportunity post-Brexit because our British banks apparently want to go over there to get access to the EU. I think we've just heard what an extraordinary muddle this is, and it's a muddle of history. The Apple argument is that we need this as an incentive for startup, and we brought startup and opportunity and technology and training and jobs, and they've been quite specific in particular areas, like Cork, for example. And Tim Cook has been very robust in his reply, a real sort of buccaneering reply, saying, so you don't want Apple in Europe and jobs and technology and all the other things that I've just mentioned. And it just shows you what a hell of a mess that they're in over taxes, because already we've had, Apple is up on the stand, Starbucks and Google can't be far behind. But I'm reminded in this of the recent book on the euro and the eurozone by Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, who has already come out roaring out of the blocks, by the way, on the Apple decision. He said, well, at last, Europe is getting serious about the egregious power and profitability, which he regards as unethical in certain senses, of big corporations like that. To which I, not being an economist myself, but a student of European affairs, I have a two-word reply. If only. I think that this is the beginning of yet another phase of a very, very big muddle indeed. And just following what we have heard, I think that it points to the incoherence of Europe. Imagine one of the people whose name this has been handed down namely the president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. What did he do with his own country? Made it one of the premier tax evasion centres of the world. Juncker in Luxembourg, of course.
Martin, it's interesting. Robert touches on a couple of fascinating points there. One of which is, you know, all these countries around Europe, you know, supposedly kind of working together in one way, but also need to attract businesses and kind of put out a bit of cream for the cat to kind of lure them into their kind of home. The Irish did that, and now we don't like it. Do you think that in a way, you know, we're being a little bit unfair on the Irish? Because, you know, they're a struggling economy. They had to do something to try and get people to set up jobs in Ireland.
Well, I think we need to distinguish between two quite different things. One is to have an attractive tax system in order to actually produce and have jobs in your country. The other is to have a very generous tax system for people who say that, oh, our intellectual property, our intangibles happen to belong in this country. Sort of, postbox placement of property that you allocate all the profit to. And the interesting thing about Ireland, which is why I think there is actually a case for withholding some sympathy, is that under every other country's rules, these companies were set up in a way that looked Irish under those countries' laws, but under Irish law, they were not Irish, which is why they ended up paying pretty much no tax anywhere else. But the bigger point is this. The world has changed. Economies have changed because companies and goods and services are now much more digital, intellectual property, intangible, which means that it's harder to say, well, where are they actually made? They're sort of made everywhere. The original idea is somewhere, but they're sold everywhere without a physical presence. So physical presence is, it's not as relevant as it used to be. Plus, after the crisis, you've had much more public attention to the fact that corporates pay much less tax than it says in the headline rate that they should be paying. So I think everyone agrees that the system isn't fit for purpose, but we'll get a lot of ructions in terms of getting to a better one.
Robert, you talk about the different phases of this, but is one of those phases actually the public just think it's about time that some of these bigger companies paid a bit more tax, even if it turns out the Irish government says they're going to kind of like appeal this decision? Oddly, a government that doesn't seem to want to be given £11 billion.
Yeah, I agree with you, because just to follow Stiglitz, I don't think, who's very broad-brush, but he follows his friend Yanis Varoufakis, of course. The thing is, it does look very odd, and I want to ask Martin about the reputational aspect of this, that these people get away with paying this very, very tiny percentage of tax, and yet you insist, the Troika, the IMF, the Commission and the ECB insist on quite draconian measures, deflationary measures and tax paying and so on, for countries that have got themselves into bother, like Greece, where it isn't the Greek individual in the street who's really suffering, and yet you see a fat cat getting away with it, like Apple. And I would add to this, I think this is serious because so many questions are being asked right around the globe about certain practices or certain aspects of the Apple brand and image, and particularly labour practices in China, for example. I think this robust, though Tim Cook's reply may have been, this is not good news at all. And by the way, it has taken the gild off the gingerbread, or tarnished, the great launch that we're supposed to be having of the new products in Europe, which is supposed to happen next week.
Martin, just kind of, you know, one other kind of point on this, upon what's happening. Yeah, here's the EU doing something rather good. Isn't this kind of going to upset all the kind of, you know, Tory right-wing press? They've said, you know, that it's the toothless EU, they can't do a damn thing. Actually, when you come down to it, the Tory government here in the UK were very quick to kind of let many of these big kind of companies, corporations off the hook. It's the EU in the end. You need some joined up thinking from Brussels to combat the power of these multinationals.
Yeah, Britain, of course, has tried to do the same thing with a patent box and so on. And most governments try to do this sort of thing. Just on the reputational damage, I think reputational damage is very important. And it's because we live in an ever more transparent society. Think about the Panama Papers. It's just much easier now for the public to find out what's happening.
I kind of agree with you. So, but just a button, let's remember, this is Apple, who had a problem with some of its manufacturing plants in China, where there was a suicide rate that seemed to be unreasonably high. It doesn't stick to you if you're making cool products that kids like, because those kids don't care who's making the products in the end. You know, we care when we get into our, you know, our 30s, 40s, 50s, and suddenly you kind of, you know, you like a bit of organic cheese. But when you're a 20-year-old, you don't give a damn whether people are working in slave labor conditions, because you want it cheap and you want it cool. And if it hits those two things, the reputational damage is very limited. I think, yes, for people like us, it may kind of have reputational damage. But do you think it really makes a difference to a 19-year-old who's going out to buy a phone or some cool gadget when they think, I wonder if they paid all their taxes this month? You don't give a damn.
Well, my guess is actually that it's the opposite, that that generation is probably more aware of what goes on and more likely to be enrolled into, you know, even digital activism. You know, of course, you know, Apple makes fantastic products. I mean, the question is, could they continue doing that if they were paying the tax that they're supposed to be paying? But just back to your point about the EU, what is clear is that no single company has an incentive to change this on their own, and no single country probably has an incentive to change this on their own, because somebody else is just going to undercut them, which is why you need some sort of common rules. And that's where the EU moves, you know, tentative as they are, because this is only one small step and it's done as competition policy rather than tax policy, can be useful.
Robert, just before we move on, do you think people give a monkeys about who makes things, whether they pay the taxes? Because, you know, it's the same for, people still eat foie gras. They know people are, animals are being exploited for it. They still buy products from, you know, cheap high street stores. They know they're probably involving child labour. They buy running shoes that they're not quite sure who actually made the final stitch. Do they really care whether Apple pays its taxes?
Well, you know how tremendously decisive I am in conversation. I agree with both of you. I think you're both right, because, as Martin was saying, there are so many different conversations about this kind of thing now. There are a lot of people take your view. Absolutely, Andrew. But the conversation in the Twitter sphere, it will be very strong about this. It has been about Apple's practices anyway. But the EU has done something which almost seems to me to be counterculture.
Things change very fast. We have to remember that. Yeah. Where is BlackBerry now? Where is Nokia now?
Nokia. Absolutely.
Where will Apple be in 5 years' time? Who knows? Yeah.
Well, that's a whole other kind of row. But we're going to have that. That's for another day. But we're moving on. Is Turkey's relationship with the US close to breaking point? Turkish tanks pushed deeper into northern Syria yesterday, a move which has prompted a stinging rebuke from its NATO ally. The US is concerned that the battle for territory in Syria means that Turkey is neglecting its fight against Islamic State militants. Robert, we have to start with you. These tank manoeuvres, it's so complicated. You know, did the US back it originally? Were they going to support it? Were they going to have special forces on the ground? We don't know. But it certainly seems they're concerned that Turkey has within its kind of rifle shots not only ISIS, but also Kurdish
but also I think it's the main effort, the Kurds, frankly, and I think that's the thing that's upsetting the US. We've got two clients, theoretically, of the US and of the US military fighting each other. That's the point of it. And it is absolutely clear, despite all the soft words from Vice President Biden, that Erdogan and Yildirim, the President and Prime Minister of Turkey, are not resiling from this. The tanks, as you rightly say, are pushing in because what they want to do is to drive a wedge between two key constituencies of the Kurds in the region. I am not going to go into a whole list of acronyms because it just confuses everybody, not least myself. But what was happening was Kurds associated with the militant Kurdish movement, the Kurdish Workers' Party within Turkey, were about to link up and create, as they do inimitably, a quasi, an entity, should we say, a sort of state across the north of Syria by linking up with a principal party of the Syrian Kurds. This is bad news for Turkey. And this is where Turkey seems to be showing itself to be a master of ambiguity, and why the big losers are, one, the Kurds, and two, the US. Because it is absolutely clear now that Erdogan, post the July coup in Turkey, has cozied up with Putin and seems to have come to a deal whose precise terms we do not really understand, but Putin has got the Turks to back off President Assad. So that's what's going on. And it's a broken back US presidency. Whatever Biden does, he is not going to change the price of fish within the region. The fighting goes on, and we'll have to wait for a new US presidency before there can be a serious intervention. But as this thing goes towards 6 years of conflict in Syria with no respite, it is very, very dangerous indeed. And they're all at it because Russia is deeply committed in this and appears to be backing Turkey in its main aim, despite all the things. Yes, we've got a twin-pronged attack against ISIS and the Kurds. It is aiming at dealing with the Kurds, who they see as a border security and a major threat.
Martin, you wanted to jump in?
I think Robert's getting at the kind of deeper thing at play here. Yeah. Russia is obviously involved. And the really interesting thing about the US is how the US clearly has strategic interest, having to do partly with Russia's role, partly with his grand bargain of hoping that Iran can be brought in from the cold in some way that is not antagonistic to US interest. That's the big long game that's being played. But it's also decided, at least under President Obama, that it's not going to take a very muscular sort of involvement in Syria. So it's not imposing a no-fly zone. It's not obviously putting boots on the ground, except for special forces. So it will depend on Turkey. It will depend on other clients. And of course, it's a problem when it's different clients fight one another. But that's always been the case, the opposition between Turkey's government and the Kurds. But because of those deeper, the deeper interest, this is not going to tear apart the Turkish-US relationship.
Robert, I want to ask you, it's very easy for us to sit here and see, the good people, the bad people. The bad people are Assad, or Putin, or Erdogan. The good people are the nice secular Kurds. But are we being a little bit naive thinking that Turkey would sit back and feel comfortable about an expanding kind of Kurdish homeland on its southern border? It was bound to find it uncomfortable and react. And shouldn't we have some sympathy for saying, okay, we understand you have an insurgency, you have a terrorism problem, these are difficult relationships. Actually, the US maybe could have done a bit better and said, hold on, you need to stop here. It's uncomfortable having ISIS on your border, Kurdish fighters. But in the end, this is going to provoke Turkey if you go further.
I agree with you. I think that it's the phenomenon known in military circles as big hand, small map. I think that neither the US or the UK, that did have very, very strong intelligence presences across this area, are really dealing in the detail as it is. The Kurds are a mosaic, an incredibly complex mosaic. And they have looked for an independent entity since the end of the First World War. The Treaty of Versailles, particularly the Treaty of Sèvres, never came about. That has been the aspiration. Because there has been a coalition of interests, particularly in the Arab world and in the Turkish world, for this not to come about. But one of the things we tend to forget, if we go back to 1918 or 1924, when Atatürk established his power, is that it was so different. The numbers in terms of population, the human landscape is tiny, tiny, tiny compared with where we are now. Here it is so utterly complex because this thing that I was trying to explain to you, for example, of the two bits of the Kurdish fighting forces linking up across northern Syria, they seem to be trying to build some kind of entity called Rojava. But if they do that, Kurds will only be one third of the population of that region, and this is why it is so combustible, and it looks as if they're going to let ISIS off the hook if they're not careful.
I just want to call you up before we move on, Martin. We've got much more to fit into this show, believe it. I even have only got 10 minutes left. Just tell me, if you were ISIS sitting in Raqqa, you're not going to be making any long term plans now, though, are you? That's the fascinating thing. ISIS is kind of it's a ticking clock for ISIS, isn't it?
Well, I think that's true in a sort of short-term tactical sense. But from the little we do know about how these people think, they take the very long view, shall we say. I mean, there is an ideological motivation behind all of this. And it's clearly also theologically driven. Well, and if you have a theology driving your policy, you take the, shall we say, the view of infinity, don't you?
The 10-second answer. Do you think that Raqqa would be a non-ISIS city within a year?
I think it very possibly could be, and I think ISIS is prepared for that, as Martin said.
Well, you're listening to Midori House with me, Agitator, Robert Fox and Martin Sambu. Now, next, the UK's Prime Minister, Theresa May, is to convene her cabinet, her countryside retreat, to discuss Brexit tomorrow. It's thought that her top team is split on whether Britain should retain access to the single market or seek out new trade deals. Well, still with me, of course, are Martin Sambu and Robert Fox. Martin, well, this is a big economic crunchy question. We've been trying to answer it for many months. I think we may be still trying to answer it for many months to come. What's your reading of the little kind of whiffs and sniffs we get of what the cabinet is thinking? Do you think they do want to have full access to the single market? They pretend they don't. Is that just them trying to kind of get some bargaining power? What's your read of what they want?
You know, whoever said this was a phony war over the summer, I think, was right. I mean, all the big questions that the referendum result raised haven't been resolved, partly because everyone's been on holiday, both here and in Brussels. I think tomorrow's cabinet meeting, or retreat, I think it is going to be when all hell breaks loose again, because these are very difficult questions. And unfortunately, I don't think anyone's really moved very much beyond Boris Johnson's stated policy of being pro having your cake and pro eating it. People, the government wants access to the single market and it wants to take back control over immigration policy and regulation. But the problem still remains that you can't have both. And I think that they've signalled, Theresa May has said Brexit means Brexit. I think, even though that's no definition,
which has confused everyone.
It confused everyone, but it does signal that the things people thought they voted for, they'll have to get some of that. And I think that means actually quite a hard form of Brexit. I think we're going to look at a departure from the single market, you know, some sort of basic trade deal, Canada style, but nothing like the current relationship.
Robert, we haven't got a huge amount of time, but hard Brexit, doesn't sound very nice, does it? But do you think that's what we have coming for us as a breakfast?
I don't think they really know where they're going, and that's why Martin unfortunately pinched the line. Brexit means Brexit. The trouble is nobody I really know in politics and in comment really knows what Brexit is going to look like. Because what we have to say is within a year or just over a year from now, what is Europe going to look like? There are some really big things in the road. The Italian referendum might be a lot more fun than people realise, because it could see the end of Renzi and a movement for Italexit. but also the people who are trying to redesign, allegedly by Dutch government sources tell me that Hollande and Merkel are working like beavers on a secret blueprint for EU reform. Oh, come on, you know, they're likely both to be out of office within 2 years. We just don't know what it's going to look like. But what I do admire the lady for doing it the way she did. She is saying, really, now, you tell me what you want. We're a cabinet, we work together, and I think this is a lot of fun. And I think she's being very, very shrewd in playing, I think, it looks to be, a very long game.
I'm only going to give you 30 seconds to this one, Martin, but the FT has been accused of being kind of like a bunch of, you know, worse than the kind of French insurgency. You've been, you know, saying everything's going to go wrong and you've overestimated the damage of Brexit. When you look back at the reporting between the vote and now, do you think your paper has got it right, roughly right? Because everyone else is saying it's all kind of champagne and roses out there. You know, you've completely missed the mood. Do you think there was a bit of overstatement by the FT?
I don't think so. Well, you'd expect me to say that, but to justify
it. Well, I wanted you to keep your job tomorrow.
In terms of the news reporting,
you're a cool man.
You know, the FT has reported more than probably any paper, because it is a premier business newspaper, all the various results. And a few of them are kind of positive. Most of the survey evidence is very negative. But the point is that real economic data is always a couple of months behind. So it's only now, in a different way, that the phony war ends and we're starting to see the real damage.
Very, very good answer. Now, we have a minute and a half to deal with a huge problem of Venice. Now, Robert, you wanted to talk about this. There's some questions about whether we should have fewer tourists going to Venice. Whenever I hear this said, I always think they mean they don't want common people going, because they don't want the kind of tourist packs. They don't want the ships going. They don't mind a few posh people going to have a kind of few drinks at the end of the day. What is the solution for Venice if you try and stop the hoi polloi going? Is it just only to allow smaller groups of wealthy people to go and stay?
To float off and over a very long period to die with dignity, because it is a dying city. The thing is, this mass tourism has put intolerable pressure on the place. It's a city that I've known and loved and visited a lot of times for more than 50 years. And by the way, I'm not saying, oh, woe is me, it was wonderful in those days. I tell you, people have been moaning about Venice almost since the place was built, but certainly since Napoleonic times. You can read letters from ambassadors, sort of Henry James type grand ladies, saying it's all gone to the dogs, it's pollution, there's cholera, there's God knows what. The trouble is, it is a museum city and can only live as a boutique and as a tourist destination. And tourists come in ever larger ships, and they're wrecking the place for a start. That's the big crisis, is that really the place is breaking up with these huge liners coming in and people wanting to go and gawk. But actually, the sad thing is, if you come in by a big liner or on a package tour, you didn't spend all that much money in the place.
Martin, some 60,000 people tramp through Venice every day, walking over those little bridges, trying to squeeze themselves onto a gondola. Is that too many people for a city like Venice to cope with?
It probably is too many people, depending on how you define coping. But if you wanted to have a semblance of a real city where people live and work, it probably is too much. But what do you do about it? I mean, any economist will tell you there are really only two ways to reduce demand if demand is too high, and it's either by charging or by rationing. If you charge, that means it becomes a destination for the rich. If you ration, well, you need some other mechanism of choosing who gets to come.
But it's fascinating. In Barcelona, they've just passed a whole series of laws restricting Airbnb, saying that there can be no new hotels to be built. This kind of revolt against the tourist is quite a big thing in many popular cities now. Why do you think that people have got so fed up with tourism, even if it brings in so much cash?
Well, I think it's two things. One is that if it is too much, it's both unpleasant and you can afford to stop it. If there's that much demand, you can restrict it, and that means prices will go up for the tourists. They'll bring more money in, so you can afford to do that.
Robert?
Italy is having a fantastic year for tourism too, because they don't want to go to Turkish beaches, or let alone Tunisian beaches. And tourism has gone up by something like 20%. The Italians, in the most delightful and diverting way, love to moan about it. They think it's terribly funny. And the great thing about Venice, it always was a place of entertainment. I don't think it's dead yet, but I think it really should make a lot more of its sort of dying swan image. I think we love it for it. And we love talking about it, and it is still great fun. And I've been in Italy three times so far this year, and it's still an amazing place, though the place seems to be going to hell in a handcart if you read the headlines.
Although I do hear the most sophisticated people are going swimming in the lakes in the Netherlands at the moment. Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. The show was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Molly Ingleby. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next. And at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Henry Rhys Sheridan. And we'll have more on the day's news stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.